Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney and broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Ben Robinson, and coming up on the program...
Yes, I do see some virtue in it, that's for sure, but overall do we see it as the right policy?
With over 30 countries having a sugar tax in place by the end of the year, can we expect one in Australia anytime soon? Also on the program.
I think there's some great opportunities in agriculture that are being overlooked by the super industry. We want to bring that to their attention, make sure that they don't overlook agriculture when they're weighing up their investment options.
North American pension funds invest much more in their agribusinesses than Australia, and the government has just announced that the Agriculture Standing Committee will launch an inquiry into super funds to find out why they are not investing in rural Australia. First, financial advisers have been leaving the sector by the thousands, but probably not for the reasons you expect. Since 2015, changes to the sector have led to the departure of 7,000 advisers who have retired or found alternate work. With the advent of the Royal Commission into banking, stringent regulations could be implemented, and the number of financial advisers leaving the sector is predicted to reach 14,000 over the next 5 years. Kevin Suarez spoke with CEO of Wealth of Advisor Ratings, Mark Hoven, about the changes to the industry.
So why are financial advisers leaving the industry?
Advisers are facing a very different environment to what they had a few years ago. Back in 2014, we saw new rules come in called Future of Financial Advice, which banned the charging of commissions. It required advisers to get clients to continue to opt in to fees, and there was something called the best interest test that was introduced. Those changes were quite fundamental to the industry, and they, in many ways, changed the environment for the long term. The profitability of advisors and advice businesses were really altered forever. A lot of advisors left the industry from that point. We've seen 7,000 advisors exit the industry in the last 3 years since those changes were implemented. Now we've got more change coming, Kevin. It's primarily called the new educational standards for advisors are compelling advisors who don't have a degree to essentially get a degree. They've got 4 to 5 years to do that. But for a lot of the advisors who are in their 50s, maybe in their 60s, without that educational background, are saying that they don't want to go down that pathway. So we believe the natural attrition that we've been seeing for the last 3 years will continue, but will be increased and enhanced by these additional changes.
Where are these financial advisors going after they leave the industry?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Some are retiring. As I say, a number of them are closer to that age. Some are retiring. Some are changing careers and choosing to go into different industries. Some are moving within the industry into non-advice roles, so they're moving into supervisory or management roles, and some are taking a break.
Is there wealth management issues similar to those that you've mentioned here happening in Australia, happening on a more worldwide scale?
Well, certainly a lot of the things that have been playing out in Australia to some extent were preempted in the UK. So the UK introduced a lot of these changes that I've referred to, the FOFA, F-O-F-A, changes and the higher educational standards changes a few years ago ahead of Australia. And we saw a very similar event. We saw something like 25 to 30% of advisors in the UK industry exit. We've seen that industry or the volume of those advisors in the industry recover in the UK. So we're going through a very similar pathway.
Are the big four banks starting to move away from wealth management?
Yes, I think it's on the public record that for a number of the banks that they see a sunset on their involvement with wealth. All of the banks, by and large, bought into wealth businesses in a very substantial way 20-odd years ago. They bought life insurance businesses, fund management businesses, stockbroking businesses, and investment platforms, and life insurance. We're seeing a dismantling of that, now, particularly on the life insurance side. That's already playing out. CBA has sold its life insurance business, ANZ has sold its life insurance business, and MLC has done the same. And now we're starting to hear about fund management operations that might be sold, advice businesses that might be sold. And so we are seeing a gradual exit from the wealth industry.
One of the biggest factors influencing the financial advisor industry nowadays is the Royal Commission into banking. So how much of an influence is this Royal Commission having on the industry?
Well, in terms of the impact on the wealth industry, I think it's just to some extent turbocharging what has been playing out for the last 3 years. The future of financial advice reforms were strong and fundamentally right. And I think what we've seen from the Royal Commission is the execution of those reforms has not been perfect, has not been as efficient or as effective as maybe government and regulators had hoped. So it's about reinforcing those changes, potentially introducing additional ones, and probably a sharper, stronger focus on the execution of them. You know, the governance and controls around ensuring that what the rules say need to happen are what's playing out on the ground.
Before the end of the Royal Commission, interbanking happens within a couple of days or weeks. Could there be any more influences from this Royal Commission on the industry and on financial advisors, or could the brunt of the impact have already happened?
Well, we as you say, we've got a little bit more time to go with the Royal Commission. Firstly, there are a number of submissions being made to the Royal Commission following the recent hearings into financial advice. So those submissions will be assessed and evaluated, and I think will inform the Commission about some of the recommendations they make. Then we've got another session, the Royal Commission, that will be relevant, and that's the inquiry into superannuation and life insurance. You can't talk about superannuation and life insurance without non-advice. Those are very material industries that have financial advisors in their organisations, have relationships with financial advisors, and I think particularly on the superannuation side, have a wonderful relationship with the members and a wonderful opportunity to promote advice in a positive way. Advice is a positive experience. Done well, can change people's lives and improve their financial well-being. Superannuation funds have a wonderful opportunity to help promote the value of advice and to get more Australian superannuation members getting help. But having said all of that, you know, the Royal Commission is showing it can drill deeply and it can uncover stuff, things that are not being done well, not being done in the right way. And I expect they'll find some things in the review of super and life as well.
With the exodus already starting within the industry, as you mentioned, since about 2014, 2015, and especially now that the public is starting to lose their confidence in financial advisors, how can the industry adapt to survive so that people are still getting that good financial advice that you just mentioned?
I think it's important to say that a very, very large proportion of the advice that is delivered is good advice. A very large proportion of advisors out there are doing the right thing and are providing advice in the best interest of their clients. Unfortunately, that story gets lost with the headlines around the bad apples and the legitimate instances of bad behaviour, both by institutions and by individuals. So the industry has to professionalise. It has to continue to do the things that are required to become a profession that can be trusted by consumers. The good stories about advisors and the value they're delivering have to be told. Our platform, Advisor Ratings, is a rating and review site. It's got a lot of positive news on our platform. Very high proportion of the reviews on our platform are positive and speak about the good things that advisors are doing. But the industry has to focus on the right outcomes, which are client best interests, and then deliver.
Mark Hovind, CEO of Wealth Advisor Ratings, ending that story by Kevin Suarez.
My name is François Carrière. I am at the UTS Business School, and you are listening to On The Money, summing up finance in one easy bite.
I'm Ben Robinson, broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER in Sydney. Obesity is a growing problem in Australia, with almost 2 in 3 Australian adults and 1 in 4 children being classified as overweight or obese. Although our national rate of obesity is nothing compared to some countries, it has increased significantly over the past 2 decades, from 19% in 1995 to 28% in 2015. In total, almost 30% of the world is obese, and some countries are solving this problem with a tax on sugar. The idea has been floated in Australia before, but never taken seriously. But, in a surprising announcement from Coca-Cola Amatil last week, a sugar content in Coca-Cola products will be cut by 10% by 2020. The sugar tax isn't a new concept. Denmark had a tax on soft drinks in the 1930s, and politicians in the US had proposed a similar tax as early as 1914. But by the end of 2018, more than 30 countries around the world will have implemented a tax on sugar, such as the United Kingdom, Ireland, and Mexico. The potential financial benefits of these taxes are undeniable. A study by the US Department of Health and Human Services estimated that a sugar tax could generate over $14 billion of revenue in the first year alone. But what is the purpose of taxing sugar? Here's what UTS marketing lecturer Dr. Natalina Slatevsky had to say.
If you're charging consumers more for something, then it should have an effect on purchases, so they should be buying less. Research has shown that the sugar tax is expected to result in a decline in purchase and consumption, particularly in the area of, for example, sugar-sweetened beverages. But it's not clear what the actual effect on weight or on obesity levels will be. And that is important, considering that that's the whole idea of introducing a sugar tax.
So would the introduction of a sugar tax actually work? Would it actually achieve its goal of tackling obesity?
No. We're all outcomes focused, and there's no evidence anywhere in the world that a soft drink tax helps reduce obesity. We do support low-rated and broad-based consumption taxes, which Australia already has, but we believe the best approach in terms of healthcare is to provide people with choice and information rather than increased taxes on families and on individuals.
You just heard Christine Black, the Director of Sustainability for Coca-Cola South Pacific. Last week, Coca-Cola Amatil, the bottling company used by the Coca-Cola company in the South Pacific, announced a pledge to cut the sugar content in their products by 10% by 2020. Although they won't be changing the classic Coca-Cola formula, it will apply to the other drinks in their portfolio, such as Sprite, Fanta, Mother, and Powerade. This announcement follows a series of similar actions taken by drink manufacturers in the UK before their sugar tax came into law this April. However, Christine Black assured me that this decision was not made in anticipation of a sugar tax, but was more a response to consumers.
We've heard consumer feedback that they're trying to moderate the sugar in their diet, and we're taking proactive action to help them do that. We've been taking action since 2015 and before that. The goal to reduce sugar by 10%, we've set ourselves a baseline from the beginning of 2016 onwards. So we've set ourselves a period of 5 years to reduce by 10%. Really, it comes down to being a consumer-centric company. We know we need to listen to consumers.
Although the sugar tax is aimed at tackling the rising problem of obesity, we can't ignore the possible ramifications Australian cane growers might face as a result of a sugar tax. Australia is home to roughly 4,400 sugarcane farms, the majority of which are located in Queensland, the state responsible for 95% of sugar produced in Australia. Roughly 85% of this produce is exported overseas, which brings in about $2 billion annually to the Queensland economy. Needless to say, it's a huge industry. So how would a sugar tax impact Australian cane growers? I spoke to the CEO of Queensland Cane Growers Organisation, Dan Galligan, to find out.
While the producers themselves wouldn't be taxed, a tax imposed on a food manufacturer provides another disincentive for them to use sugar. And indeed, what they do is instead reformulate into other synthetic sweeteners, but those synthetic sweeteners are used in preference to sugar to avoid the tax, and therefore that obviously has an impact on market share for the cane grower.
Mr. Galligan stresses that the damage a sugar tax could cause to the local sugar industry would not occur overnight, but would have a slow-burning, long-term impact.
Immediate job losses wouldn't be obvious, that's absolutely true. It's a long-term to medium term impact on the industry. If the tax was to work in reducing consumption, it reduces particularly that domestic consumption pile and therefore has impacts on the businesses that refine sugar for domestic use and grow cane. Over time, as the domestic consumption would reduce, if the sugar tax was to work to deliver that, you'd certainly see businesses contracting size, not immediately, but over time.
Turning to the political front, I spoke to Queensland state politician Robbie Katter, whose electorate in far north Queensland is home to many sugar farmers, and he believes that the implementation of a sugar tax could harm sugar producers.
The price is currently 11 cents a pound, so while I wouldn't say it's break even, it's below cost of production for a lot of people at the moment. Any more blows on demand, 85% of what's grown is exported. That still leaves 15% there off the domestic market, and that can impact. I'm not going to say it would be a death blow to the industry, but it certainly would impact.
However, Mr. Katter was firm in his belief that whilst a sugar tax could be bad for producers, it would be even worse for consumers, and it could end up targeting those in low socioeconomic communities.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing trying to get sugar out of the diet. I would just question a sugar tax is the best way to remove sugar from kids' diets. You'll have people in communities that can ill afford any increase on the food that they buy paying an increase, and I think that's terribly unfair. And, you know, where you've got, you wouldn't say wealthy, but the stronger, say, middle to wealthier class people where you'll get an abundance of those sort of problems as well, that's where they can afford other options or there's other things available. You know, we're not saying it's done with the best intentions and it's, you know, will it impact on the sugar industry, but we just think it's probably a little bit simplistic in the way to address what is a terrible problem and a huge drain on the public purse in health, which is obesity.
So, whilst the calls for a sugar tax may be growing louder and louder in Australia, and similar calls may have been answered in other countries around the world, it is crucial to consider the potential consequences, whether it be for the farmers in North Queensland, the everyday consumers, or those in low-income areas. Either way, Mr. Katter strongly believes that before a decision is announced, we must look at the bigger picture.
Yes, I do see some virtue in it, that's for sure. But overall, do we see it as the right policy mix? No, a blanket sugar tax is going to capture inadvertently too many people and impact on their lifestyle, their health and otherwise, and their budget or their ability to feed their own kids in these communities. I think the damage it does in those areas is, I don't think it's worth all the positive benefit. And you might have a lot of listeners saying, well, hang on, you know, it still helps most of Australians, but you know, I hope we're a little bit more caring in Australia, that we still care about some of those really poor communities.
Robbie Katter, leader of Katter's Australian Party in Queensland, ending that report.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
You're listening to On The Money, where you can find out everything to do with finance, business and the economy. Broadcast around Australia on the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2SER, I'm Ben Robinson. The government announced today a new inquiry by the Agriculture and Water Resources Standing Committee into the lack of investment by Australian super funds in Australian agribusinesses. Risk-averse super funds have been somewhat wary of getting involved in agriculture, as there have been numerous stories of macadamia farms, wineries, or forestry schemes that have sent investors to the wall due to unforeseen weather events or market gluts that make a harvest worth little. But in North America, many funds have at least 1% or more invested in agriculture, and Roderick Chambers asked the chair of the Standing Committee, WA member for O'Connor, Rick Wilson, how far off that figure Australian super funds were.
Australian superannuation funds have got about $2 trillion under management, and I think less than 0.2% of it is invested in agricultural assets, and, you know, we think on the Ag Committee, we thought that that's a pretty low number. And so, you know, we're going to investigate, you know, perhaps why that is and whether there's any government impediments. We're certainly not looking to, you know, go down the route of mandating a certain amount of investment in agriculture. But what we're going to do is, you know, have a look at what barriers there might be to super funds investing in a greater proportion of agriculture in their portfolios.
And is it like comparing to, say, the North American market that you're saying that it's low?
Well, when we look at investment in agriculture here in Australia, we're seeing sovereign wealth funds, we're seeing private equity from overseas come in, but we're not seeing too much investment by our local superannuation industry. So we want to know why, and we want to investigate if there's anything that government can do to encourage it.
I mean, traditionally, some of the barriers, I think, would be related to the riskier nature, I suppose, of traditional agribusinesses, and that you've got to rely on things like the weather. But there's a lot more modern agribusinesses these days too. And do you think super funds are fully aware of the new sort of innovative businesses we've got?
Well, I think you're quite right. There may be a little lack of understanding in super funds on how modern agriculture works. And of course, in terms of the risk profile, that's, if you're operating a big fund, there's plenty of ways to manage risk. There's geographical spread, there's spread across various industries. But I mean, agricultural production in Australia has grown from $49 billion in 2013 to $67 billion in 2017. I mean, it is a boom industry. I'm a farmer myself. I know from personal interest in the industry that land prices have been on a steady increase, as well as increased technology is bringing cheaper production and more profitable production. So I think there's some great opportunities in agriculture that are being overlooked by the super industry, and we want to bring that to their attention, make sure that they don't overlook agriculture when they're weighing up their investment options.
I mean, investing in land would probably be an easier kind of an option, in that it's probably easier for them to track and value and that sort of thing. But really, it's really getting investment in some of the production procedures and the new ideas that we've got. Isn't that really what you'd be trying to look at?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, if you look at the avocado industry in my electorate, for example, people invested, $2 and $3 million in the industry, 10 years ago, recently sold their business to Costa's for $100 million. Now, not expecting, super funds to get themselves involved in, that sort of speculative, and it's not really speculative. It was, building a business from ground up. But, at some stage along that series of events, there's investment opportunities for big players. And, as I say, Costa's, see value in that business at $100 million. So, there are people out there who are prepared to invest. Now, as I say, super funds probably don't want to be involved in the management of those businesses, but certainly being involved in, in owning some of the capital assets of those businesses is possibly good return for their members.
Yeah, I mean, in Australia, we've got quite concentrated retailing and wholesaling. Is that, a bit of an impediment as far as the investors go?
Look, in certain sectors, where there's not a ready export market, yes, that probably is something of a disincentive. But where there's an export market, and I'll use my industry, the wool industry at the moment is seeing record returns, and that's on the back of every bale of wool produced in Australia is now exported. Our wheat industry, our cotton. All of those industries are based on exports. These are investment decisions that individual, funds and investment, vehicles will make themselves. But, I think there's plenty of opportunities in agriculture if you look hard enough. And I just think at the moment they're not looking at all.
But even, I suppose, like the super funds, they could think globally as well and think, well, maybe I should look at investing in, olive groves in Spain, say, instead of olive groves in the Barossa.
And that would be a legitimate thing for them to do. Australian agriculture, on world standards, probably up there with the best, and there's probably not too many industries that we can say that. So, of all the industries that Australia is involved in, agriculture is one that we can, probably quite rightly say that we are amongst the world leaders.
So, is there a better way to get a marketplace, I suppose, going between super funds and actual, agribusinesses?
Well, one thing that we're quite keen to pursue and talk to people who have tried to, attract investment in their
IPOs or companies that they've formed from super funds and had no success, to find out, firstly to find out if there are people out there who've tried to attract investment. Because, as I say, super funds don't want to be, I assume, involved in companies that require management and are necessarily exposed to particularly high risk. But, managed funds that invest, particularly in agricultural assets. And we'll be talking to them to see if, if they are attracting any interest from the super funds.
So what issues you think are there for the regulators? They mention it, and you've also mentioned it, for, ASIC, APRA, ACCC.
Well, that's what I don't know those issues yet. That's what we're there to find out, whether those regulatory bodies are, do impose any barriers to investment, and if so, what we can do about them.
Yeah, because that's something that being in government, you might be able to fix up.
That's it. Like I say, this is probably more about assisting the industry to make investment decisions rather than any sort of regulatory impositions or mandating. That's certainly not on the agenda.
Federal Member for O'Connor and Chair of the Agriculture Standing Committee Inquiry into Superfunds, Rick Wilson, ending that report by Roderick Chambers. That's all we have time for on The Money this week. We hope you'll tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Hello if you are listening via 2Bob FM in Taree, 3BBR in Drew in Victoria or 4CCR in Cairns. And a special shout out to fellow On The Money producer James Hughes. Hope you get well soon, mate. Thanks to producer Kevin Suarez and our executive producer Roderick Chambers. On The Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network. You can find all our shows and stories at 2ser.com/onthemoney. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter, look for @onthemoney2ser and find us on Facebook. We'll be back again next week to give you the inside running on everything financial. I'm Ben Robinson. Thanks for your company.